Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey, everyone. Welcome in to the weekend edition of the KE Report. Corey and Shad here, your hosts for this weekend's edition. Also your hosts throughout the week on our website and podcast. Boy, oh boy, first week of May already, I would argue, more interesting than pretty much the whole month of April. This week, we had some key central bank meetings like the ECB and the Fed, although not a whole lot changed from expectations in those meetings. We also had the jobs data at the end of the week, a lot to talk about and some market volatility, but I guess in all fairness, again, the market's not really going anywhere other than sideways. We'll talk about it all and recap really big picture here in the first half of this weekend show, and in the second half, we'll dive more distinctly into some individual sectors with trading strategies from one of our fund manager guests. We are kicking off this weekend show with Peter Buchvar, Chief Investment Officer at Bleakley Financial Group and editor of the Book Report website. Now, Peter, earlier this week, I posted an excerpt from one of your reports from the Book Report that really addressed this whole concept of everyone calling for a recession in the second half of this year and the outlook, at least the market outlook, of how many rate cuts the Fed could do by that January meeting. The market is now pricing in up to 4 cuts by that January meeting. Now, Peter, you made the argument in that article that I posted that, look, everyone can be right about a recession coming, but that doesn't mean that the outcome of what the Fed does or what the markets do is that cut in stone. Can you take us through your outlook here on this whole recession coming, but not all recessions are the same?
Right. Thanks for having me. So as night follows day, a recession follows an expansion, and they typically happen when the Fed is raising interest rates. So to say that I think there's going to be a recession when the Fed is raising interest rates, especially as aggressively as they have been, it's not a profound thing to say that we're going to have one. I think under the hood, it's what type of recession are we going to have? That's the real question. Are we going to have one that's deep or one that's shallow? Are we going to have one that's short or are we going to have one that's drawn out? To me, those are the real questions. To think that the Fed can raise 500 basis points in a year on a debt-dependent, credit-dependent economy, and we're not going to have a recession, to me, just makes zero sense. To me, it's just a matter of what type of recession we're going to have.
Well, Peter, along that line of thinking, you know, we haven't really seen this kind of an experiment before in monetary policy, where we went from the record lowest rates in history to a very aggressive rate increase cycle that's taken it from basically zero to 5.25% in such a short amount of time. And most of these rate hikes haven't really had time to percolate through the economic system yet. So even if the Fed doesn't immediately rush into rate cuts like the Fed funds futures markets are expecting, what do you think the effect of these higher rates are going to be on things like the real estate and commercial real estate markets or the auto industry? You know, what could these higher rates mean for just business loans rolling over?
Every single month, every single quarter that goes by now, somebody's loan is repricing at a much higher rate, and I emphasize much higher rate than the loan that is coming due. And that's why this plays out over time. If I'm a household and I took out an adjustable rate mortgage in October 2013, and it was a 10-year ARM, well, in October of this year, it's going to reset at a much higher interest rate. But at least right now, I'm not affected yet. I have 5 months left. Maybe I probably built up some equity. So while I'm not feeling it yet, I'm going to feel it soon. If you're you're owner of a multifamily commercial real estate building that's 98% occupied, wow, you know, it looks like it's doing great. But if you have a 3.5% loan that's coming due this year and it has to reprice at 8%, well, chances are you're either going to have to raise more equity and pay down the debt and work out something with your bank, or the bank's going to foreclose on you if you don't have the cash flows to fund that much higher interest expense. So, like I said, this plays out over time. It's not an event. Fed raises, we go into recession. It's a process that takes time because not everyone is affected by the rate change all at once. But eventually, everyone does become impacted if rates stay higher for longer.
So since we're talking about rate changes then and who gets impacted, let's also tie in the banking issues in the U.S. because, well, we saw more news of the banking issues this week with J.P. Morgan taking over a failing bank and then another bank, reporting failures. What does this mean, playing into this whole recession call and playing into Fed policy in your eyes?
So in totality, at least in the U.S., bank lending makes up about 20% of all lending, with non-bank lending, capital market sort of balancing it out. So on the surface, it looks, okay, well, it's not that much, whereas Europe, 80% of the lending comes from the banks. But of the 20%, small and medium-sized banks make up almost 40% of all lending, and most borrowing for small and medium-sized businesses come from banks. You know, if you're going to open up two restaurants, Goldman Sachs is not going to take your call to do a junk bond deal for you. You have to go to the local bank, put a personal guarantee on a loan that you're going to get. So I'm most worried about the impact on small and medium-sized businesses because of that outsized market share that the banks have. And that kind of lending for smaller businesses. You look at commercial real estate, small and medium-sized businesses have a 67% market share when it comes to lending in that space in the banking system. So, but it also has ripple effects throughout because what's affecting the banks also affects others. So when was the last time, you know, we're barely having any IPOs. You know, we had a successful one yesterday. It was Kenvue, but that's from Johnson & Johnson, and they sell Tylenol. Well, you know, that's a much easier IPO than generally speaking. VC funding has gotten much more difficult to get through in terms of investment committees. And just the cost of capital, generally speaking, across the board is more difficult. Now, private equity, you know, they'll be a source, but, you know, they'll charge you an arm and a leg to get equity or debt capital from them. So in the aggregate, it's a credit crunch that we're in the midst of. You know, that's going to have a lot of ripple effects that, like I said earlier, will take place over the coming months, quarters, and throughout this year and probably into next year if the Fed keeps rates high for a while.
Peter, I think it's an interesting point you just made about the lack of IPOs. There really haven't been hardly any. And if you think back to 2020 and 2021 coming out of the pandemic, it seemed like there was a couple dozen IPOs every week. Now, the question I have is some of those companies also, you know, took out debt and loans and different things to be able to fund their ventures that have no signs of showing any revenue. Are we probably going to see a wave of some of these IPOs from the past that are non-revenue generating companies go the way of the dodo bird as this cycle plays through?
Well, the scenario you just laid out was one of the reasons why Silicon Valley Bank went down, because they had a lot of VC companies that were burning cash, that were hoping to tap the IPO market to liquefy themselves, pay down debt, pay back investors, but weren't able to because the capital markets closed on them. And then they started drawing down on their bank deposits and so on. Yeah, so there's no doubt that investors are focused on profits and they're going to be much more discriminating on who gets money, whether it's an equity investment or it's a loan. You know, you can be sure that's going to have a ripple effect throughout the economy. And we're seeing this type of commentary in many different places.
So since we're talking revenue and earnings, let's talk about this last earnings season that we're broadly through right now. At least big boys reported, a lot of big tech reported last week. Apple reported this week. Overall, we saw a lot of earnings beats, but those were on vastly lower expectations. And when you compare it to the prior quarter or the quarter from last year, well, we are seeing revenue decrease and we are seeing earnings decline. But again, it did beat the street's consensus. What did you pull away from this earnings season, Peter?
Well, let me start by saying that every earnings season companies beat about 70 to 75% of the time, the estimates. Just the game that's played where estimates come down going into the quarter, and then you beat those lowered estimates. I think big picture, earnings are going to be down year over year for a second quarter in a row. Profit margins continue to degrade, and that's what's most important. Because as earnings slip, cash flow is slow. That means less capital spending. It's going to mean less hiring, and there's, you know, the flow through there. So that's what I am taking away. And but putting that aside, to me, the first quarter was a two-part quarter. To me, it was everything from January 1st to March 8th, and then from March 9th through the end of the month, because March 8th, 9th was when Silicon Valley Bank went down. So to think that the economy would stay on the same trajectory post-SVB, I think is going to be proven to be a mistake. So from what I've seen and what I'm hearing from individual companies that we hear from and go through a lot of earnings calls and transcripts is that for many, business slowed in April, and that was, again, reflected probably in the back half of March in people taking a step back and seeing how it played out with SVB. And I've seen that commentary in whether it was consumer spending, Cloudflare, a tech company, talked about big change in behavior that reminded the CEO of March of 2020. That was pretty profound comment. So to me, the second quarter is going to be really sort of the new environment where the economy continues to adjust for better or for worse, and obviously for worse when it comes to the banking system, to this much higher cost of capital in a very quick shock therapy type way.
Well, Peter, we'll keep our eyes peeled for the Q2 season to see how it shakes out. But another takeaway from Q1's earnings season that I saw was that, yes, there was some of the big mega cap companies that reported pretty good results, and they've been the one carrying the indexes. When you look at the S&P 500, when you look at the NASDAQ 100, there's the big companies that are carrying the day. But when you look across the market breadth, a lot of the companies actually didn't do that great. And when you look at the microcap stocks like the Russell 2000, it's making 52-week lows. So what do you make of the divergence between some of the big mega cap stocks that are carrying the indexes and the rest of the market that's not doing quite as well?
Well, that's a very important distinction to talk about, sort of the bifurcated market that we're in. And even these big cap companies, which are great and dominant, but the growth rates are slowing across the board. I mean, you take Apple. Apple's revenues fell 3% year over year. Their operating income fell 5% year over year. I mean, these aren't really robust growth companies anymore. Meta had very little revenue growth. Microsoft's revenue was up 7%. Again, great companies, but the yesteryear of double-digit robust revenue growth is over. The law of large numbers is just harder to grow, and they're still all subject to, you know, the macro environment, which even Apple touched upon. Luckily, you know, Apple still has some emerging markets like India that they can tap into, but the developed world business is slowed, and but just also the nature of their product line. You know, who doesn't have a smartphone at this point that you know of, at least in the developed world. So, but these are big cap names, and investors don't want to don't give up hope in owning things that already worked over the past 10 years. They're basically dusting off the old playbook. But I don't think that is something that's going to be sustainable. And I think to your point about the Russell 2000 really dragging here, you know, you take the S&P 500. You take out eight stocks, that makes up all of the gain this year in the S&P. The other 493 stocks are basically down on average this year. So it's, or at best flat. So definitely a two-way market, and that's not usually the sign of health.
Now, can we tie this into inflation outlook if we are just seeing, let's say, trouble for a lot of stocks and shrinking revenues and shrinking profit margins? Some companies do still have pricing power, but overall, does this end up filtering into the inflation data?
Well, we're certainly seeing moderation in inflation, which should continue as the year progresses, particularly on the services side as rental growth has slowed. That's not fully captured yet by the inflation stats. To me, it's not a question of whether inflation is going to slow from here. It's a question of after it slows, where does it settle out at? You know, when you get this inflation spike, yeah, you're going to come back down again, just on easy comparisons. But is it really a question of, oh, if let's just say we hit 2% inflation come November, December, do we say, oh, wow, the Fed's hit its target? No. Again, that's just the backside of a sharp rise in inflation. It's what happens in 2024, 2025, of where does inflation settle out at? Is it we're just going to go back to this 1% to 2% pace that we got very accustomed to that allowed central bankers to go hog wild with policy? Or are we in a structurally higher rate of inflation, maybe 3 to 4, which is down below where we are today, but higher than what we're used to? And I'm more in that camp, because 3 to 4% inflation also means that interest rates stay higher for longer and the Fed's not just going to be able to go back to zero and, you know, ramp up QE again as easily as they did before.
Well, Peter, when you think about last year, 2022, it was really dominated by the discussion of inflation. That's all anybody wanted to talk about. That's all the Fed really wanted to look at as far as their guidance. And it seems like the end of last year in Q4, the narrative started shifting a little bit more to, hey, it looks like tough times are here. You know, we got the yield curve inverted. We've got some manufacturing data coming in weak, home data coming in weak. And the recession narrative really, you know, the war beat started drumming up on that. And then we started hearing, yeah, but we can't be going into a recession because look at these good job numbers. And if people remember, in February, we got those January job numbers and they were way better than expected. Well, just here on Friday, we've seen the same thing again, where people were looking to all this economic data being concerning, the banking system, but then out comes the job data and it shocks people with 253,000 jobs created. I think they were expecting 185,000 jobs at consensus, and then unemployment came in better than expected. So once again, people are saying, look, good times are here again. We can't be going towards an economic contraction because look how well these job markets are going. What do you make of that argument in the face of Q1 earnings where so many companies were laying off employees?
Well, it's two things. I encourage people to go back since World War II and see that recessions began with unemployment very low, because when they're very low, that's just the precursor to them eventually ticking higher. With respect to the payroll number for April, it actually was a very much a mixed bag. The headline number beat expectations by 65,000, but there was a downward revision to the two prior months of almost 150,000. So net-net, it was actually a weaker than expected number. Within the household survey, there was a drop in labor force participation, or I should say drop in the size of the labor force, which combined with a rise in the household survey, which calculates the unemployment rate, that's why the unemployment rate dipped down. The positive was the wage growth, which still remained pretty steady. The negative, in addition to what I just mentioned, you had temp workers down for a third straight month and the fifth time out of the past sixth. That's usually a precursor to future hiring, because if you start cutting back on the temp workers you just hired, well, historically, that means that you're going to start laying off permanent people. Also, there's something called the diffusion index, which basically measures the degree which companies and sectors are hiring versus sectors that are firing. And that remains off some depressed level. So to me, there were some definite holes in this number that lead me to believe that from here, the pace of hiring is really going to slow. And one last quirky thing is something called the birth-death model. Usually it misses inflection points. And I think it's missing this one and overstating the job growth. And I expect that means that this number will probably get revised lower. So job growth is still certainly good. Unemployment rate is still low, wage growth is still pretty good, but I'm seeing some pockets and seeing some holes that that I think plays out from here in the months and quarters to come.
So again, just all tying it into the second half of this year and the issues that the economy, the markets could see, which then relates back to what the Fed's going to do. But again, the market is pricing in about up to 4 rate cuts by that January meeting. And by pricing in, that to me means that markets might be getting a little ahead of themselves. I personally don't think that the Fed's going to get 4 rate cuts, but again, it's impossible to know for sure. Peter, how do you balance out looking at these markets, even looking at individual parts of the market, when we are being told that the market's already pricing in rate cuts by January, quite a few of them?
Well, that's the thing is that the market generally, it's like no one wants to miss the Fed is done rally. I've sensed it over the past month, people hiding in these big cap tech stocks. No one wants to miss that rally, thinking that the Fed being done somehow is the cure here. You know, maybe it is, but when you look at the two bear markets pre-COVID, markets didn't really bottom until the end of almost the end of the rate cuts. And you know, taking what the bond market's pricing with the Fed funds rate, if you go out further, you go out till next summer, July 2024, market's pricing in 200 basis points of rate cuts. So there's that, but I think that is coincident with growth that is going to really slow from here. You know, that's going to hit earnings, and I just don't think that the bear market is over.
Well, Peter, just to this point, what do you think about the bond market's take on it as far as when you look at the 2-year, which usually tracks the Fed fund futures, you know, they're usually in alignment. You know, it's at 3.928, almost 3.93. That's still higher than the 10-year, which is at 3.45. But the Fed funds future rate is now about 5.25%. So there's a pretty big spread there. And that's also just complicating bankers' lives even further as far as what they can lend out versus what, you know, what they can get in interest. So what do you make of the bond market where it's at this point?
And it's also complicating the banks that are paying 0.01% on a deposit rate when people can get much higher rates elsewhere. Yeah, I mean, the yield curve to me is obviously flashing red in terms of the belief that the Fed is overdoing it at this point with rate increases. Now, the Fed obviously is focused on inflation and thinking that the banking crisis is going to somehow go away without much implication. But yeah, there's no doubt that it's flashing red, and it's hard to ignore. And that's why, again, we're going to have a recession. We're probably beginning one now, post SVB. But the relevance, again, is more the extent of it.
So one other thing, kind of outside of all this economic data that is being written about a little bit more, some of our guests have brought it up too, is this whole debt ceiling debate, which I feel like we've been here before a number of times, but it seems like this debt ceiling raise is going to come down to the wire again. Peter, any implications on markets, on Fed policy around this whole debt ceiling?
The only relevance is if you happen to have a Treasury bill that is maturing around this so-called X date, where we don't know truly what the X date is, being defined as when the government literally runs out of money. Janet Yellen hinted at it was in the beginning of June. So if you have, let's just say, let's see, so let's call it June 1st, and June 1st is a Thursday. So let's just say you have a T-bill that matures on Friday, June 2nd. Well, and you're closing on a house that day. Well, I would not wait for the maturity on June 1st. I would probably sell that now and have your money elsewhere if you plan on closing on a house on June 2nd. Because probably by that Monday or Tuesday, this will get resolved. So to me, it's just a timing issue of those that have debt possibly maturing around the time of this X date. Because you can be sure at the end of the day, the politicians talk tough, but in a crisis of some sort, they'll all buckle and they'll come to a deal, and we'll have this debate all over again in 12 to 24 months.
Yes, Peter, it's very much like Groundhog's Day in that we'll just keep living the same process over and over again, as we have for really the last two decades. It is interesting, though, how the U.S. dollar is responding to all this, because you would think that debt ceiling debate and some of these other issues would be negative for the dollar. It has been weak, but you would think that the Fed hiking rates would be positive for the dollar, and it's still remained weak. Now, I know it's counterbalanced against other global currencies and what other central banks are doing with the Bank of Japan, Bank of England, what the ECB is doing to the euro, and that has buoyed those currencies against the dollar. But what is your outlook for the future trajectory of the greenback?
The dollar is really more focused on the rate of change of monetary policy. And if I look back over the past couple of years, to me, the dollar rally has been solely dictated by the aggressiveness of the Fed. And once they slowed that pace of aggressiveness, the dollar then reverted in the opposite way. So the dollar rally really started in earnest. And we'll use the DXY, which we know is dominated by the yen and the euro. June 2021 FOMC meeting, Jay Powell at the press conference said, we're finally thinking about tapering QE. That's when the dollar started to take off. And that rally lasted through October 2022, just as the Fed was ending their fourth rate hike of 75 basis points in a row. So once the market started to smell out, okay, well, the Fed's done with these 75 basis point cadence of rate hikes, and they're about to slow that down, that was the top of the dollar. And the dollar's been falling ever since. And to me, that said, you know, this was obvious that, okay, the Fed was more aggressive than the ECB, Bank of Japan, and the BOE, and certainly against the Swiss National Bank. But then when you take a step back, well, dollar wasn't – actually, the Mexican peso traded great over the dollar the past couple of years. Canadian dollar was pretty steady against the U.S. dollar. Even the Brazilian real, because their central bank was very aggressive, traded well against the dollar. So even when the dollar was rallying, it was only rallying against some currencies. Yeah, it was rallying against the Turkish lira. Well, you know, that's easy to understand. But so that to me, that just tells you that, you know, the dollar's got some major flaws here. If these are the things that are moving it higher. But like I said, now that the Fed is basically done hiking, which I think they're done, and I think they should have been done in March, I don't know what the bull case is left for the dollar other than, well, the other currencies are crappy too.
Yeah, it continues to be an argument, doesn't it? We've heard that one time and time again. Peter, let's bring this full circle then in terms of how you're managing or how you're advising some clients within these markets. I know that you have like the precious metals. Precious metals have made a run, at least gold, towards some all-time highs. It is in an overbought position, but we can't say many other things are in overbought positions. Markets, you said that, look, you think the bear market is still intact. How aggressive are you being right now? How much are you playing defense? What is your overall market strategy?
Hasn't changed that much. As you said, still involved in precious metals, still like energy stocks, notwithstanding the dip here in oil, but I still think it goes much higher. Still focused on trying to find some, you know, deep value stuff that didn't really participate of the last bunch of years, trying to avoid these big cap tech stocks that unfortunately for me have done well, but I just don't think is sustainable. As I just think that we're in a new investing regime, and thinking that the old stuff is going to work the same as they once did is going to be a mistake. I still like international markets, particularly those in Asia. And I mean, look at Europe, for example. We don't have too much exposure in Europe, but we have some. You know, the European markets are pacing double the pace of the S&P. So that weaker dollar, if it continues, I think will benefit international markets. I particularly like emerging market local currency bonds, that you can get some good yield and non-dollar exposure. And I think just having some extra cash, which we do, and trying to be judicious with it, and believing that if the bear market's not over, that implies that there are going to be some really good opportunities still to come. And I want to emphasize that bear markets are actually the best time to be buying stocks, because that's when things are on sale.
All right, Peter, great spot to end this. Thank you very much for your time. Really appreciate all you do at The Book Report and you sharing your thoughts on our show. I'll reach out to you in another month or two. Again, thank you very much for your time this weekend.
Great. I really appreciate having me on.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout.